Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley with my co-hosts Tom Coffey and Scott Hoag. Today, we're going to be talking about IPv6 and happy eyeballs. We're joined by Dan Wing to talk about his work around the IETF and IPv6, and specifically happy eyeballs, since he was one of the co-authors for that RFC. And Dan, welcome to the IPv6 Buzz. Why don't we dive right into it, and we'll talk about RFC 6555, or more commonly known as happy eyeballs for all of us out there. And I'm sort of interested where the heck did the name come from, but we can talk about that too. But what exactly is happy eyeballs, and why is it important?
Hey, everybody. So happy eyeballs is important to select your IP address family. So the old problem that we had with browsers especially was they would take a minute if the IPv6 connection didn't work. Either the server was down, or the routing didn't work, or your v6 was being filtered, or whatever. And it would take a minute to fall back to the next address, which, if it was another IPv6 address, would be another minute. So rendering was kind of slow and annoying when IPv6 was not working. So Andrew and I talked about that for a while. Listened to an interesting presentation by Stuart Cheshire of Apple at IETF that he gave, and came up with a simplified technique to prioritize what happened with an IPv6 versus IPv4 connection, and published it as happy eyeballs. So its value is making that connection work fast. So instead of a 1 minute timeout, which is your traditional TCP connection timeout, it suggests something around the range of 250 to 400 milliseconds or so, and that's what folks have implemented in browsers, in order to get that v6 connection timed out and fall back to IPv4.
Okay, and so for folks that are listening that may not have heard of happy eyeballs and sort of the big concept, it was really about the end user experience as much, you know, the protocol failure stuff and everything was built into the protocol itself in terms of failing from one to the other, V6 to V4, for instance, or V6, one bad V6 connection to another bad V6 connection, as it would be, and then back to V4. But it was all about the end user experience of really what the end user got to see and what the host operating system got to see in terms of performance and behavior of what's happening on the network when it had both V4 and V6.
Yeah, it is. It's all about the end user. So, and that's where the name kind of came from, is those end user networks are often called eyeball networks. It's where the eyeballs are.
Right.
So those are, you know, that's what your internet service provider is connecting those eyeballs to the rest of the internet. So it was keep the eyeballs, the people looking at the web browser, keep them happy. Keep them happy with IPv6 and make them not want to turn it off, which was very important.
Yeah, I remember, this is Scott, I remember seeing at IETF 80, the V6 Ops Working Group, there was a really nice table that described the fallback times based on which operating system you were using, which browser, how long it could possibly take. And then I was first introduced to happy eyeballs when you wrote the IPv6 or the Internet Protocol Journal article that you wrote September of 2010. So it was right about that time I started to become aware of those problems and see them too.
I remember, I think the first time I saw you present was actually at the Google Implementers. I want to say it was at the Google Implementers conference. Yep. I think Tom was there too. And I think I think at that point you were talking actually about NPT V6 as opposed to happy eyeballs, if I remember correctly. But I remember there was a lot of yelling and shouting about what performance and impact things could have as sort of a lead up to World IPv6 Day, right? Because everyone's saying, like, you know, do we want to do this? Do we want to turn this stuff on? There was a lot of conversations around that at that time, like what impact was going to happen on the internet when V6 is turned on and we have all of these structural problems sort of out there where we don't know where the brokenness actually is. And certainly, you know, the people that were, you know, talking about this the most were probably Yahoo and Google and I don't know who else at the time. I mean, Tom, you were doing a bunch of work around this for talking about for CDNs, right? In terms of what Limelight was facing.
For Limelight, yeah, to try to help some of the content providers solve that problem at the infrastructure layer, as far as, you know, making it go away with well, frankly, how a lot of enterprises have made it go away to date, which is, you know, turn up your website at the edge using a CDN or hosting service that supports IPv6 and then you can go back to ignoring it on your internal network, which you wish they wouldn't do. But
I remember at that Google Implementers conference, they gave away really cool shirts that was six :61E, you know, it spells Google, but it used the :: and on the back it said ipv6.google.com.
I wore that because, until it fell apart.
Yeah, it was a cool shirt. But at the time, you know, there was www.google.com, which was a v4 only site, and ipv6.google.com, which is a v6 only site, which wasn't what we wanted to have happen, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, which is, I think, to Dan's point about sort of the split between the DNS base entries, how many V6 addresses you would advertise versus how many V4, and the fact that we were playing games in DNS namespace. And I think back then we were whitelisting, right? We were doing the whitelist.
Oh, we're still even doing a blacklist. Google is pretty famous for the blacklist that they continue to run for refusing to advertise the IPv6 address for www.google.com for DNS queries coming from DNS servers belonging to service providers who have poor performance for their IPv6, and the users are suffering either, you know, page rendering speeds or whatever.
Yeah.
And that actually, you know, takes me down a good direction for Happy Eyeballs and some of the things it doesn't fix yet. There's some movement in the industry to fix it, but probably using some adjacent technologies, not exactly like IPv6. And some of it is, you know, what Happy Eyeballs is doing is what connection works fastest. And that's how it's making its decision. And that's what's in the spec. Kind of naive and kind of simple in that way, that whatever connects first might not be the best connection. It could be lossy. It could be low bandwidth. It could be high latency. So it could be a satellite connection, and your fast cable connection or your fast fiber connection, for example, could have just exhibited a tiny bit of packet loss for the SYN or the SYNAC, kind of throwing the numbers off a little bit. What's interesting is Apple's taken a technique that's quite sophisticated in their implementation. In fact, they wrote Happy Eyeballs V2 is RFC 8305, and it takes into consideration the subnet you're connecting to, as well as a specific IP address, under the assumption that everything belonging to, you know, a certain CDN provider who are co-locating everything inside of one data center probably have similar sort of characteristics because of the network path and the distance to it and everything, and use that to help kind of augment the Happy Eyeballs algorithm for how long it takes to fall back to IPv4 and how long it takes to do a DNS query for a DNS A record versus the quad A record and such like, all of which help with the user experience and also help with one of the important design aspects of all of the Happy Eyeballs implementations in various products, which is always prefer IPv6. It might hurt the user a little bit if there's no quad A. It might hurt the user a little bit if the V6 path is broken. But by preferring IPv6, we have an exit strategy. We have a way that when IPv4 is less common and less monitored, and IPv6 is more common and more monitored and more robust and more working as well as IPv4, and, you know, with outages and with BGP announcement problems and things, then Happy Eyeballs continues to work. The algorithm can stick around in implementations, but it doesn't have a residual long-term harm to the internet, which is really important. If instead IPv6 and IPv4 are given equal weight, then it makes it more difficult to eventually turn off IPv4, and it makes it more difficult to turn off some of those carrier-grade NATs, especially that wireless providers are using worldwide.
Right. Well, I mean, that's really interesting. Let's talk, maybe we can pivot and talk a little bit about the implementation then, because for me, one of the challenges always with Happy Eyeballs was like, what part of the OS actually is implementing Happy Eyeballs, right? To figure out what's going on. So maybe we can iterate a little bit through that, because I know you had early on and given some guidance around some of it, and maybe not everyone took that to heart. But what I know, browsers were some of the first things to sort of implement Happy Eyeballs, and then obviously operating systems chose to implement it, and, you know, Microsoft did it very differently than how Linux implemented. Maybe we can mash through some of that and talk through some of the implementation practicalities of what happened with Happy Eyeballs itself.
Sure. I talked a little bit about what Apple's done. Apple's implementation is all in their own APIs in their operating system on both macOS and iOS. So it's not really in their browser, and any application can use those same APIs and get the benefits of Happy Eyeballs and all of the other connections that other apps have also used on that operating system, you know, on that device, which is kind of nice, kind of powerful. Firefox and Chrome have gone in very similar directions. Their implementations are mostly like what's in RFC 6555 and the original Happy Eyeball spec, in that it's a simple timeout of the v6 connection is ignored, and the v4 connection is kicked off very quickly. So what they're really doing behind the scenes is sorting the addresses that they get back from the quad A and the A queries. And if there's multiple v6 addresses, only the first one is attempted to connect to. If that fails, after, depending on how it's configured, you can change this with about config, but around 250, 300 milliseconds, then they will fail over to the next non v6 address. And this all works also the way the code is written for all these platforms that I've described, is if you change the address ordering to prefer IPv4 in the operating system and not prefer IPv6, but still allow it to be used and still have it configured, that's honored too, and that all works with all of the code. So you can change your address preferences in Windows, and it's a little harder, but it's possible to change in macOS as well, so that IPv4 is preferred over IPv6, and then it all works the same, but backwards and prefers IPv4. But the default that, of course, comes with the operating systems is to prefer IPv6. Where there is a difference in philosophy is with Microsoft, both with IE and Edge, at least Edge's I've played with it so far, in that they don't do happy eyeballs. Instead, when the Microsoft browsers wake up, they attempt to talk to an IPv6 only site that Microsoft runs. And if they get a response from it, they assume IPv6 works, and they use IPv6 and prefer IPv6 and do a normal timeout and make connections and everything's okay. If when they start, when they launch, they try to connect to that site and it doesn't work, they assume IPv6 is not really working, and then they only do A record queries and only connect to IPv4 network.
Right. Right, and they suppress it for a time period, so they do all the things within the RFC. You guys put some specs in there about sort of giving people ways of getting out. And if your computer stays up for 30 days and it did that first initial check, it's not going to check again, assuming the network interface doesn't reset or drop or anything else like that. So it keeps the state for a pretty long period of time. I was actually a little surprised about how long they actually chose to do that, but they use something called NCSI, or the Network Communications, or was a Network Connectivity Status Indicator. I should know this.
Yeah, it's a very similar technique that's used in Android and in macOS and in Apple iOS in order to display the Wi-Fi PI to detect that we're really connected to the internet.
Right.
They all use a very similar technique to do that. And they're, with all of those, the internet is IPv4 works. What they did with Microsoft Edge and Microsoft IE was kind of extend that idea to, oh, IPv4 works to the internet. Cool. Let's see if IPv6 works to the internet and connect to an IPv6 only portal, get back a success response. And that means it works. And if they don't get back a success, they then assume IPv6 doesn't work for 30 days, which is quite a long time. On the other hand, people have laptops, not desktops anymore. So you connect and reconnect to a network all the time, at least every time you go home and then come back to work, you're reconnecting. So it actually does start again each day.
Yeah, test it again. Exactly. Yeah. And it was an interesting trade-off. I mean, I spent a little bit of time talking to Dave Thaler around what they were thinking about doing this particular method versus just implementing happy eyeballs in the way that Apple and Android and Linux have implemented within their kernel. And he was like, for some of the challenges for application developers in terms of trying to debug and figure it out and having something that was really consistent, they felt that was going to give a more consistent, at least experience for troubleshooting and trying to figure out what was going on. And I can see and sort of appreciate that in terms of what they're doing there. It does cause a challenge for those that are in the operator space who are trying to figure out what's going on the platforms, right? When you're as a help desk trying to figure out exactly what's going on. It's a little harder because you need to know the nuanced differences between what's going on in the operating systems. But I think that's sort of true across the board, even among all the different flavors of Unix, right?
Yeah, for sure.
You still have to pay attention to that stuff. I mean, it's for me on the implementation side, it seems like there was pretty good adoption within the software development community overall and the application, operating system folks that Happy Eyeballs really seems to have addressed many of the, initial need requirements about making the transition possible from IPv4 to IPv6. So sort of tip of the hat to you and Andrew about getting something out the door that I think it turned out to be incredibly useful to make the transition that much better. It's pretty awesome. And I think that's something that sort of goes unnoticed. It's maybe one of those silent things. It's like you see V6 creeping up there in terms of stats and performance and everything else. And I think Happy Eyeballs is one of the unsung heroes of allowing that to happen as consistently as it has. There's a couple other technologies within Stack that I think are pretty important to you, NAT64, DNS64, and probably 646X LAT sort of fit in those categories. But definitely for me, in terms of making my life easier and talking to customers and folks, it's one of the things that people scratch their head and say, like, how's this happening behind the scenes so well that we're not really noticing or knowing what's going on, but there's this, pretty impressive adoption rate. And this is one of the reasons why, just for the audience to know my unbiased, unfiltered opinion on that one.
And it seems like we're all sort of biding our time until IPv6 gets to the point where, we can sort of remove some of this labyrinth of address selection that includes Happy Eyeballs, that includes, RFC 6724 and how that's implemented at the operating system layer. We see progress on that front, heading in that direction. But obviously, I think all of us feel it's not fast enough. It would be great to be able to remove some of these impediments in terms of troubleshooting for the operators.
Yeah, to that list, I would add the RFC 4074, the common misbehavior of DNS resolvers. Where we have an A record and a quad A record in two separate packets. Like, why do we need to do that at this stage?
I find it interesting that so many people are just unaware of what actually happens in the operating system and in browsers to make their experience what it is. And this is one of those things that just sort of highlights that over and over again about people taking the time and effort to sort of figure out what this problem is and actually come up with a solution for it. Pivoting off of that, because clearly Happy Eyeballs as a structural mechanism to sort of solve this problem, and it doesn't matter, it's not a V6 only sort of thing that we could talk about here, but those same principles apply as new sets of technologies get adopted and we need to move the greater internet sort of forward in adopting those things. The same methodology can be used or stamped out. And it's obviously the technical details are going to differ based off of what you're actually trying to do, but the principle overall will stay the same, right?
Yeah, and the principle is don't make the users suffer for the nerds. the nerds want a new transport protocol. The nerds want a new IP version. The nerds want, a new HTML. They want a new version of HTTP, HTTP2 versus HTTP 1 and 1.1, for example. Is those negotiations, that determination that have to happen in the protocol for, a offer answer exchange for SIP or a HTTP accept for HTTP, or the first TCP SYN gets sent over IPv6 or IPv4. Those sorts of protocol things, yeah, they're all different. You need to know how to make those really go away so the user doesn't suffer through the transition. And then after the transition is complete and everything is using HTTP2, let's say, or everything is using IPv6, let's say, the existence of that transition mechanism doesn't continue to cause technical debt and operational complexity and harm, but instead becomes just an afterthought, something that is still there for probably, unfortunately, a long time while the transition completes and everyone's old laptops quit working and old software quits working and you drop your 10-year-old favorite cell phone on the pavement one too many times and it finally breaks and you have to buy the new one that does do IPv6. That the technologies that are there don't continually to send out too many packets or harm CDNs or harm content providers with the old legacy stuff that they were doing. Mm-hmm. So I think some of that some of the CLAT 464 stuff, for example, I think Happy Eyeballs, for example, are technologies that are doing the least harm that they can to get the transition to work and be successful and people to leave IPv6 on without having a long-term painful legacy that, we need to carry along with us.
As a nerd and a user, I appreciate, applications being more aggressive to make the end user experience better.
Yeah, when you have the bandwidth, you know, or the packets, you know, that month, you know, in your budget, you know, if you're on a bandwidth limited plan, I agree, you know, it's great, and that's where some of the preference for IPv6 is helpful. You're still sending out the DNS queries for a quad A and an A, but as long as the network gets you back a connection on IPv6 in a reasonable amount of time that we are pretty sure is not going to already upset the user too much, then, you know, it's fine. You're not going to waste any more bandwidth because of that IPv6 support that's in there. So,
well, as they say, nothing dies on the internet, right? So, we were talking with Stefan on the T-Mobile side, and it was like, yeah, and Scott had an interesting point. What was it about the...
Oh, I said, how do you get from 95% to 100% IPv6 adoption on your mobile devices? Do you have to get customers to give up their burner phones?
So like all these old flip phones and everything else is the last scrape in the bottom of the barrel, right? Of trying to get rid of devices off your network, and it just will never happen, right?
You'll never see, the old DOCSIS 2.0 modems, you know, the old, you know.
Yeah, the long tail of obsolescence.
V4 only embedded devices that still, you know, plague our environments.
Plague our environments, Scott. That's awesome. It's a plague.
See, you're revealing your nerd prejudice there as opposed to the user preference. the network would be great if it wasn't for all those pesky users.
Yeah, it'd be awesome. It'd be a lot more bandwidth for us.
But things I'd like to see, you know, was mentioned earlier, was how can we, you know, get rid of these independent IPv4, you know, quad A and A DNS queries? How can we optimize that? There's been proposals floated all over the place, but nothing's really stuck. There was a both address record, a resource record that was being considered, and a couple other ideas. But I think it's something that can help some optimizations as DNS moves towards DNS over HTTP, the DOH work that's being done in Deprive, DNS Op, that sort of work, and the DNS over TCP work. I think some of those optimizations will become more valuable there because both of those are currently running over TCP. We'll probably move to running over QUIC, so it'll be DNS over HTTP over QUIC. But all that impacts some of the Happy Eyeballs success, I would say. It doesn't impact the algorithm per se, but once it's running over a reliable transport like TCP, you come into head-of-line blocking issues with the DNS queries and responses, network head-of-line blocking, not server head-of-line blocking, which change a lot of the dynamic for, you know, how long do I wait for the DNS answer to come back and when do I retransmit it and things like that. Because now it's stuck, kind of stuck running over a reliable transport of TCP. So once that does move to DNS over HTTP over QUIC, it can run over an unreliable QUIC channel and more closely mimic the behavior of DNS over UDP, where each query is independent from every other query and there's no network head of line blocking. So that's kind of a concern for me on IPv6 is how all that works, and if someone smart and curious and interested proposes a technique that gets adopted to combine the A and the quad A queries and responses, would be nice. You know, would be a nice optimization as well.
I think Scott had mentioned was Cloudflare. Cloudflare came and presented at our North American event at LinkedIn, I think, talking about that, right, Scott?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've been the ones who've put forth some proposals to go back to maybe the old way of doing things where we do a query for any or all, you know, as opposed to separating them. And, you know, the issues there that we have two, and we don't have misbehaving DNS resolvers anymore. And we have very new operating systems and faster connections. Yeah. So, yeah, anything you do like DNS over HTTPS, you're doing TLS, you're DNS over TLS, you know, you're all those little handshakes you do delay the end user in getting the address to then make a connection, and it adds up and it impacts end user performance and they notice.
Yeah. And the timeouts that we have for Happy Eyeballs are kind of based on about what we get out of DNS over UDP. And that can be some of the studies I've seen so far on DNS over TCP. It can get quite bad with DNS over TCP with high packet loss.
And that, and this is an impact for like mobile providers or folks that are maybe on a different sort of a satellite connection or things of that nature, where maybe even, you know, their impact of performance is really due to latency and loss due to the type of transport that they actually are making use of, right? Versus like a high bandwidth, you know, residential subscriber or something of that nature, right?
Or you're doing DNS over TCP and you're fighting for TCP port space because you're going through a CGN.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, hopefully that DNS over TCP connection stays up and doesn't get torn down, so that you have something. You at least don't have to do a new TCP handshake and a new TLS, you know, for each DNS query you're doing. That is certainly not going to work well. You know, fortunately, with a lot of satellite, you have local DNS cache. Most people are going to the same places all the time, you know, Facebook, Google Docs, Office 365, whatever. And not really going too far out of there. And if they do, you expect it to take a little while and you're on satellite, so you must be a patient person anyway. There's TCP proxying as well to, you know, to appease the local TCP stack and make it think that the connection is succeeding, even though the data is slow to arrive. So there's a lot of tricks that are done by all the satellite, residential satellite providers to kind of make all that feel a little bit better. The users, you know, are going to configure either automatically from their browser, though, or manually because they read something in a newspaper to use, you know, Quad 9 or 1.1.1.1 or Google's DNS or, you know, some DNS, and the browser is going to try to do DNS over TCP. Without, if it does that without comparing it to sending the query over UDP and doing something kind of like NameBench, if you're familiar with that, it tests responses to all the different name servers, and you can add more. It tells you which name server is closest to you. Without doing something like that, the A record and the quad A responses that come back can be harmful and can throw off how Happy Eyeballs makes its decisions, because, you know, headline blocking, because geolocation of the IPv4 versus IPv6, and those are some things that make it more difficult, you know, make Happy Eyeballs more difficult and a little more complex and some operational difficulties to troubleshoot what's going on.
Yeah, I've used NameBench in the past, but lately I've been using DNS Diag and the DNS Eval utility. Feed it a text file and it'll compare performance of different V4, V6 DNS servers.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. DNS Eval is part of the DNS Diag toolkit.
All right. Well, awesome. Well, I suppose I should ask you the fatherly question of how long you expect Happy Eyeballs to still be sticking around, like the 5, 10, 15, and 20 year sort of time frame. But I think you answered a little bit of that as saying, so like you expect it to sort of gracefully go off into the sunset as something that's just there, but not necessarily being tapped as a resource as more and more traffic moves to V6. It's not being utilized. So
certainly, if you have the code, you know, and the code needs to be there because you might connect onto a dual stack network. But when you are on a IPv6 only network, you know, like T-Mobile's network that's the best example that anyone has, because everyone in the United States can get on that network if they care to. Then that Happy Eyeballs code never gets exercised because there's no good IPv4 address for it to use. So it doesn't bother. And then when you are on a dual stack network, like at your house or maybe at some hotels and stuff, then it's being used. And when you're on an IPv4 only network, like at your parents' house or whatever, then, you know, it's not being used at all. And I expect that mix is going to continue. You know, there's going to be many enterprises that, you know, get overwhelmed with IPv6 and how long the addresses are, and they look like, look like MAC addresses or, you know, whatever. And they don't want to do it. And there's going to be some that have a mix. And so the software, I think, and the device might connect to anything, you know, and so the software will need to be in there for a while. I would actually expect until we're finished with IPv4 and turn it off in most places on the internet. So when, you know, a major website like, you know, WordPress or Facebook or Google or someone decides, you know, it's time to finally turn off IPv4, that's, I expect, when that Happy Eyeballs algorithm and the address selection can be removed from a lot of devices but you still are going to have enterprises that are going to insist on holding to IPv4 internally. They're going to have printers that are IPv4 only. So they're going to need to run either network translation, IPv4 to IPv6 translators, which are specified, but no one knows what to do with them yet because you don't need them. There's not IPv6 only content from anywhere normal. that's a whole nother discussion.
All right, fantastic.
Well, hey, unlike V6, we've run out of space for this podcast. So Dan, how can the audience follow you on the internet? I know you're on Twitter as @Dan_Wing. But obviously, you know, you have a tremendous amount of work in the ITF and other areas, is in social media, maybe. I don't know. How can folks reach out to you?
Yeah, I'm probably most active on Twitter. So that's probably one of the better ways to get a hold of me. And my email is danwing@gmail.com.
All right. Fantastic. You can reach all of us at the IPv6 podcast on Twitter. So @IPv6Tom, @ScottHogue, and @EHorley. Those are our Twitter handles. So feel free to hit us up, especially if you have listener questions. So we've gotten done this whole one on Happy Eyeballs. We would love to have some questions, and maybe we can bring Dan back to answer a few if enough come up. But you know, with that, we want to thank you for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps, or just search for IPv6 Buzz. And please check out all the other content on Packet Pushers. They do a fantastic job, really good stuff up there. And so long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.